I must admit I am a very conflicted person. On one hand, I have a major issue with Adam and Eve. They had this great life set out for them, an impeccable life, and they blew it. They ate the apple. And yet, as I look at suffering in my life, as I look at trials and tribulations, I see how they've made me want God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, when I was growing up, I had the thoughts of what I think a lot of young people have. I grew up in a home that had lots of issues. Lots of hard things happened in my home. And I don't know if I ever thought directly, I don't want a life like this. My marriage won't be like this. But I certainly thought about my life being pretty great. I was going to have a great marriage, probably pretty symptom-free, kind of a symptom-free life. I wouldn't have said that it would be perfect, but things were going to turn out well. They weren't going to be this hard. I was going to make the right decisions and do it well. I've been really surprised by life. Really surprised by life. Really surprised. It's like life has hit me like a rear-end collision a lot of the time, because I really thought it was going to be so much easier than it is. Mm-hmm. I keep hoping for that, I think. And yet, as I grow older, I lose that more and more. I kind of expect that life will hold difficult things. I don't hope for difficult things, but it seems like that's what life is about a lot.
Yeah.
Did you share that dream as a young child?
Oh, yeah. I suppose that's very natural for us. And I would describe it the same way. Life is a lot harder than I ever imagined or ever suspected that it would be.
And are there a lot of rear-end collisions? Have there been in your life?
Yes. Yeah.
You didn't know they were coming?
Didn't know they were coming, yeah. But the more I study, the more I realize that's as it should be. That's what God is doing. That's how God sanctifies us, is through what the Bible calls the trials and tribulations of life. There's really two things, and I probably need to separate them. There's really two things that I think go into my experience of life. One is the kind of inherent futility of life that perhaps we've talked about before, but life just isn't really good enough to satisfy us. It's not really what we were made for. We are made for something bigger and better and grander than this. And so life is always just kind of a tad disappointing to us. And that the futility of life is one thing. That would be true in the best of all worlds down here.
Like Solomon said in Ecclesiastes?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Right. I think that's exactly what Solomon was talking about. But above and beyond, in addition to that, there are all these things that come along in our lives that really test us and really stretch us. And those are what the Bible calls trials and tribulations. And it hits us like a ton of bricks or like a rear-end collision, because we are not mature, we are not wise, we are not righteous people, we are sinners. And these circumstances in our life are really calling upon us to decide to have different commitments than we naturally have. And that gets very difficult and very tough and very makes for a very agonizing life at times.
You know, one of the rear-end collisions for me has been my children. Now, I know that you know my children a little bit, but there's been no big issues. there may well be in the future. But it's just really hard to be a parent. You see that? It's a tribulation for me. It's a trial for me. In lots of different ways. Perhaps primarily in that through my children, I do have to see myself. I see the good parts of myself come out in them, but I also very much see the bad parts of myself, kind of exaggerated in front of me, like a microscope is put in front of me, and I'm looking at these selfish things that I do, or attitudes that I have, or gestures that I make that I don't like my kids to have, and yet I have, and I find that having children in that kind of viewing of my self-capacity day after day after day has become quite wearing for me. It's very tough for me. I'd like to just kind of walk away from having to look a lot of the times. It would be easier for me to control my children, to make them not be as expressive of me as they are. And I think that's really what a lot of us parents do, is we try and get our kids not to be as expressive of us in the ways that we don't like. And in so doing, we kind of quench their personalities. We quench their being. We crush it.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't crush their being, and instead we decide to keep on learning from what we see in front of us and dealing with them, not in a controlling way as best we can, but in a way that kind of allows them to grow up and to mature and to make mistakes and to fail, it is very, very difficult. And I would consider that to be a very much a trial in my life.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that, and that's a big one, that... to see my weaknesses played out in the context of their lives and know what a liability it is, and then they have to look at myself and realize, but that's me. I understand what they're doing. They're doing the same thing, and wanting so much for them to just see, but it's a weakness. Stop it. don't be that way.
Yeah.
I mean, that is very wearying. And then the other one is just to come to terms with the fact that they are their own person. They have their own will. They're free. They don't belong to me. I can't control them. There's no remote control switch, as much as I keep looking for it. There's no remote control switch that will allow me to control their behaviors. You know, having the experience to know what the consequences are of some of their choices, and not be able to persuade them to not make the choices they're making. Procrastination, irresponsibility, not working hard, not being conscientious, and knowing exactly what they're doing and not being able to do anything about it really is very, very frustrating. It plays into our expectations. It plays into our exaggerated importance we put on ourselves as parents. There's all kinds of probably false beliefs that play into why it's so frustrating to me, but yeah, it's a huge trial.
I think also, just to add to that, is that kids are really demanding.
Oh yeah.
They just want a lot. My kids particularly don't like the way I cook, and it seems like, I don't know if most parents have this problem, I think most parents probably do, but just not getting that sense of real thankfulness from my children, I put in an hour and a half where I'd rather be out picking flowers, or you know, working in my garden, or sitting down and relaxing, or reading a good book. And I sat, and I just really don't particularly like doing a lot of the chores that I have to do around the house. But I did it, and I did it because it seems like it's right to me, and yet my kids complain.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a couple of kids that it's almost every other night, Jack, they say, can we order pizza? And sometimes that's when they look at my dinner. So it's just, I am worn down. I have to say that I have my oldest son is 17, and I'm really tired. I'm really tired. My husband and I went away for the weekend, or actually just for an evening this last weekend. Stayed at a really great bread and breakfast. You'll have to go to it sometime. But it just really had a good time, and we're driving back, and I had noticed that Larry hadn't talked to me much on the way down, and he said, you know, I said, why didn't you say much to me on the way driving down? And he said, well, because you were so bummed. And he was right. In part, I was bummed because of, it was the day that Clinton got voted not guilty. And I was very bummed, quite honestly, by that whole situation. But also, I was really just worn out from life. And in part, that is from the children. And Larry said, but do you like to be married? I said, yeah, I do. Let's just fly to Hawaii. You know, let's just go to the nearest airport and take off. Because that happens to be a very restful part of my life sometimes. A really good thing that Larry very much appreciates me and cherishes me and is very forgiving and wants to do right by me and also has a whole lot of, we both have a whole lot of issues that we have to work through and things that we stumble on. And I guess maybe next week if you caught me, I could say that was an area of suffering in my life. But, you know, I just really get worn down mm-hmm. by what's demanded of me.
In my experience, mothers have it even a little bit harder than fathers do, I think, with their children, because they do so much for them and give so much of themselves to the children and are so taken for granted by the children.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true of my wife and my kids' relationship to their mother. It was true of me as a kid in relationship to my mother. I just look back and in horror at how much I took her for granted and how awful I was to her. So I think it's an occupational hazard of motherhood. Just is you will be taken for granted. And it shouldn't be that way. But children are just so uncivilized. And they come into the world uncivilized. Their selfishness is raw and uninhibited.
Yeah.
And it stays that way. I mean, they, in the comfort, in a way it's in the way we could take comfort in the fact that there's at least enough security in the home that they can be the raw, selfish person that they are.
Relentlessly be the raw person that they are.
Yeah, I suppose there's a positive side that you can put on that, but it's very difficult for mothers, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jack. I appreciate that coming alongside me because, yeah, I really do experience that as one of the trials of just everyday life. And
right.
I think I share that with most every person in the world, that it's just really, it's a tough thing. Now, I don't want to, harping on the, that's not exactly the word either, but I'll say that, I'm harping on the bad parts, and certainly I don't want to leave people the impression that I don't think there's a lot of wisdom that can be gained from what's there. In fact, I think maybe that's the side I should bring up. It is in and through those sufferings. And I think, particularly at this time in my life with my children, that I am gaining some wisdom. I am gaining some understanding about life. It is hard earned.
That's why you brought this up to begin with, is that what we have to recognize is that this experience that we're going through here and now in this lifetime is a labor. It's a battle. It's a warfare. We're trying to gain ground and hold it against all the lies and deceptions and foolish ideas that we could let in and could embrace. We're trying to win wisdom and keep it and gain it against all that assails us. And the Bible always presents it as a fight, as a labor, as a war, as a battle. In Hebrews 4, he talks about striving to enter into the rest. That there is promised us a rest one day, but that rest, I think if we were to look at Hebrews 4 in context, we would recognize that that rest is for the age to come. When I enter into glory, when I enter into the kingdom of God, when I finally leave this present experience, this present age, and become a citizen of the kingdom of God, then there will be rest. I can stop laboring. But now, it's a battle against the sins of other people against me, against the futility of the world, against the sins that are in me that I commit. I'm battling against my own passions. I'm battling against being a victim of other people's sins. The world is futile anyway. It's just work, and it is a wearying experience as we labor through here to gain the kingdom of God. But then we will rest. That's the biblical promise.
And I can hear echoing in my mind, and I just need to say this because people say it to me so often. Gosh, Christine, you and Jack always talk about life being so hard now, and what is, you know, why should we even try? It's so hard. And, you know, is eternity the only thing we have to look forward to? And I would say ultimately, yeah, eternity is the best thing we have to look forward to because that's really the best rest.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, is there rest here? There is some. I would definitely say that. I certainly experienced rest this weekend with my husband. I experienced rest a lot in his love for me. I experienced rest a lot in simple joys of my life. I went out and cut my first winter flowers that are on the table in front of us today, and I was just amazed that these flowers could poke out of the coldness that we have been in here in Eugene. But they're beautiful. And they're amazing. And so there's a lot of good in the midst of this life. But ultimately, I think what we're talking about and what you bring up a lot, Jack, is this rest that's going to be so thoroughly, thoroughly satisfying.
Yeah, because it won't be compromised in any way by sin and futility and all the stuff that mars this life and spoils it in a sense or takes the edge off of the sheer delight that could be here. I mean, this is a wonderful creation, full of all kinds of goods and joys and delights. But it always gets, we always get the joy, the edge of the delight and joy is taken off by all the weary futility and suffering and agony of our lives. And that's just the way that it is. And I have a great life. You know, I mean, by the standards most people's lives, I have absolutely nothing to complain about. God has blessed me, and I'm content, and I have everything a person could ever want or need, really. So I'm not speaking from the standpoint of somebody. It's not sour grapes that I'm not looking at my life and saying, so everybody else has so much more, and so I'll just pretend like what they have is nothing. I really have been very well protected and blessed by God in material things and in physical things in this world. I have seen relatively little tragedy, and yet I think I clearly understand what the Bible is talking about when it talks about life is a battle and it's a fight and it's a labor, because it is. I am my worst problem. I have to battle against my very own tendencies to be what I shouldn't be.
Yeah, I would really echo that. I am my very worst problem. But, you know, I want to put some of what you've said into context here a little bit. I think people could get the wrong idea about your life from what you just said. And you said you were a person who has really had it very good. And yet you are also a person who does often struggle with, I think you've said on this program, wondering if you're going to have enough money to meet your monthly expenses. You're a person who also has four children, and the pressures of four children are pretty great. And just as we've said, I think you agreed with me, all the difficulties of having children are very much in your face all the time. Wanting to make your kids to make different choices or better choices, their demandingness, perhaps their selfishness, their reflection of you is very much, Jack is nodding his head,
yeah,
is very much a part of your life. You lost one of your children.
Yeah.
How old was he? Two.
Two. Yeah.
And in a tragic accident. So I don't know everything about your life, but certainly those are difficult things in your life. So you're not saying, "Gosh, everything's been hunky dory."
No, but I'm just thinking of, you know, I think of the people who come out of almost horrific family situations where they've been abused one way or the other, abandoned, I mean, I came out of a very, very secure home environment. I think a very stable and healthy and substantial marriage that gives me a great deal of delight. My children are not rebelling and doing drugs and breaking my heart in any number of ways. I mean, we have our everyday irritations, but it's just the everyday irritations. It's not the really tragic stories that some people could tell about their children and their relationship with their children. So I'm just saying that relatively speaking, life has been pretty smooth for me. We did lose our oldest son in a choking accident. That was very traumatic and was a very important thing in our lives in terms of teaching us and testing our faith. But that's mild compared to people who lose all of their children in one accident and some of the things that you hear that happen to some people. Mine has been relatively smooth.
Jack, tell me what you learned from the death of your son.
Well, I say learned, but really my experience of it was not so much learning anything as having it revealed to me that I had learned something. There were harder things in my life than losing my son. Not harder in the sense that they were more important to me, but harder in the sense that I was so fighting God. I think in a past program I alluded to at one point thinking I was going to go crazy because I was trying so hard to find a way for history to not be history. And
what you're saying by that is something that occurred in your life you didn't want to allow to be real. You wanted to deny its validity.
Yeah, exactly. It was during that time that I learned that God was God. God was running my life. He was going to have my life go the way He was going to have my life go. And He wasn't really asking my permission. And I learned that I needed to submit to that reality earlier in my life. So when it came time for God to decide your two-year-old son is going to die now, I really genuinely think I had learned that lesson to a substantial degree. And so I was able to say, so be it. Okay, if that's the way you want this to go, God, then you're in control and you have the authority and the right to do that. And I trust you, your wisdom and your love, that you know what's best for me.
Okay,
I really was able to do that.
You were able to accept what was in your life. You were able to say, okay, God hasn't turned on me. This is not a tragedy beyond what should be, because you had learned that lesson.
Right.
But I want to, I know this is a little off the direction you're going in, but Jack, so many times you make assumptions that you think other people will be with you, and I'm not sure they are from the comments I get. And you were able to accept that, but in the context of immeasurable grief.
Oh, yeah. He was just incredibly precious to me. You never know when you lose a child, you always kind of, you wonder to what extent are you idealizing, to what extent are you making that child larger than life. But I can't help but wonder if he wasn't just a little, that his assignment was to come into the world for 2 years and be a real, I don't know how to describe it, but he was just so full of life and energy, and there was a purity about his life that makes me wonder if he wasn't sanctified at a very early age, in other words.
If he was your angel.
Yeah, he was. He really was my angel. And so losing him was deeply grieved me. I mean, it was a tremendous loss. So, but, immediately I had to face the question, okay, what are you going to do with this? God took your child. He was in control. It didn't have to happen. The circumstances were such that I had to go. He choked on an almond. Jody and I, actually my wife was in labor with our second child, And we were just kind of trying to distract her from the discomfort by going out to eat and going shopping. So we'd gone to a pharmacy, and we had got in and got the things that my wife needed. We're actually in the car, and my wife said, almonds are on sale. And I said, oh, they are. And I kind of like almonds. So I went back into the store for a second time to buy these almonds that my son ended up choking on in the car on our way home. It was an experience where I suppose even to this day I have trouble. It's very emotionally difficult for me. It's horrifying to actually remember the experience, because the panic and the anxiety and the horror of the whole thing. It was a very nightmarish experience. So there's nothing about the experience that I take lightly or that I like in any way or enjoyed in any way. It was an incredibly nightmarish and grievous experience. My point in telling all that is, it was very clear that God was going out of his way to say, I'm going to set up circumstances so that I bring your son home now, because this is his assignment. His time is up. He's going to come home now. So for God to give me such a bundle of joy and then take it away, I had to ask the question, what am I going to do with that? Is God a good God who would tease you with such joy and delight only to take it away from you? But as I say, I had already been there. You know, I had already settled the issue of who this God was, that was my creator and the author of my being, and that he didn't do stuff like that because he was being malicious or capricious or uncaring or frivolous or anything like that. That he was a wise God who had my best interest in mind. And he performed major surgery on my soul at times, and that was quite painful, but that it had a purpose behind it, had a point to it, and he was making me into a better person by the things that he did in my life. And I think I was just so convinced of that by that time in my life that I didn't really struggle with coming to that conclusion. In that case, I had earlier in my life, but in that case I didn't struggle coming to that conclusion. I still felt the grief, but I didn't fight God on it.
And I think we're making a very big distinction there. You felt the loss. You felt
very,
it tremendously.
Very deeply, yeah.
But you also had the confidence in God working in your life and understood that this was part of it.
Right.
Jack, one of the things that you keep saying, and I imagine that it's just really bugging some people that are listening to us, is you said that God had this plan, that God decided to take your son home. What you're talking about is that God is designing hard things in our life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that it wasn't just God's permissive will or God having to step aside for Satan, or this was kind of a none of those things, but you are definitely saying that this is God's will, that hard things would come into your life.
Yeah, I mean, I've become convinced, and I do think that experience was, it certainly was not the only thing that has shaped my thinking in this regard, but I think it was an important contributor to it. Coming to terms with what the sovereignty of God, coming to terms with how much of my life is under his control, and how much of it is just so much random noise and static in the universe, and how much of it is authored by some evil enemy of God or something. And I had to begin to think that through at a deeper level. And the more I looked at the Bible, the more I became convinced that there is no random noise in God's universe. God is absolutely and completely and totally and utterly in control of every nanosecond and every molecule and every little aspect of every detail of everything that happens in my life. So my going back and getting those almonds was not just a random act that just didn't work out. It was God directing history and making it turn out exactly as he had ordained from before the foundation of the world. I think I would have gone crazy if I didn't believe that.
Why?
Because if I believed that I would have been eaten up by regret. You know,
I shouldn't have gone and got those almonds.
Yeah.
Why did I do that?
Yeah.
Why did I put them in the back seat or wherever they were?
Yeah. Because that was the thought. The one thing that if I struggled with anything, that was the thought, is, Jack, you fool. Why did you need some stupid almonds? And if the only way I could answer that was, Jack, this was no accident. This was not just something that could have been avoided if you had just done something differently, if only you had done something differently. God was in control of everything. And if it wasn't that way, it would be another way. But God had in mind that you were going to lose your son. So instead of eating my heart out with regret over what if only I had done this, if only I had done that, and there are about 15 million if only that would have changed everything. Instead of eating my heart out with regret, I could just take comfort in the fact that this was no accident. Accidents don't happen.
Oh man, we are really entering into a big subject here, and I'm a little reluctant to talk about it now. I think we ought to leave the sovereignty of God issue. I think, though, in a lot of people's minds, they're thinking, so what then? Are you a puppet? Do you have no free will? And that also those two things come hand in hand. Almost always when we talk about God's sovereignty, and it really raises the hackles on the back of people's necks. So I think we're going to have to enter into this discussion at some point, but I just don't think today is the day to do that.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
Sure, yeah.
Because we really wanted to talk more about suffering and trials and tribulations. So let's drop back into that again. And you and I just started this subject by talking about kind of the mundane trials of our lives. And but there's people that have much, much more difficulty in their lives. We see that throughout the course of history. Huge tragedy, huge torture, huge obliteration of families, of cultures, of just horrible, horrible things have happened. I would like to address that. But before we do that, can we define what a trial is? And can we define what a tribulation is?
Okay.
Are they different?
Well, they mean something different, but I think they come to the same thing from the standpoint of New Testament teaching. Tribulation would be probably what we would call pressures. That's probably the closest idiomatic English word for it. It's those things in our life that that put pressure on us, that are forces that are at work in our life that we have to deal with, that we have to reckon with.
Like our children, as we were talking
about
earlier.
Exactly. Yeah, that very clearly would be a tribulation, I think, in biblical terms. A trial, tribulations are trials. A trial simply means something that is testing and evaluating my faith, essentially, or my character, if you will. They test it. They are opportunities that allow my heart to reveal itself for what it is, and for the commitments of my heart to show themselves. So,
would it be that for the commitments of my heart to show themselves, and also for the commitments of my heart to be established?
Yes. Yeah. Good. The trials both, they do two things. The word means to evaluate them, but I think the way that we see trials talked about is that they not only evaluate them, but they kind of confront us with the choice that we need to make in life. And it's in the midst of the so-called trials of life that we really make those life-transforming choices and decisions that, no, I don't want that, I want that. I don't want my life to be about this, I want my life to be about that other thing. And therefore they establish and deepen and root deep into my heart the commitments that I need to make. We tend to think of trials as being the adverse circumstances in my life, the negative things, the bad things, the tragedies, the traumas. But I think from a biblical perspective, a trial could be virtually anything. It could be the successes in my life. It could be the victories. It could be the good things, the blessings that happen. Those could equally well try me. Because I think what the Bible has in mind is God simply sets up circumstances that strike me in such a way, given my own unique personality and character and history and so on, they strike me in such a way that they force the issue, they raise the question in a very dramatic kind of way. Jack, what do you want your life to be all about?
Okay, let's get an example of one of these positive ones, one of these...
Well, let's say, let's take an extreme example. Let's say someone winning $60 million in a lottery, for example. On the one hand, we would all tend to evaluate that and go, wow, boy, that would be great. What a wonderful thing that would be. But on the other hand, not necessarily with everybody, but you can certainly, I think it's easy to imagine a person winning that and now all of a sudden having to face into some important questions that they've never faced before, really, in a realistic way, of what's important? What is my life all about? What am I going to invest my life in? How do I want my life to go? And what values do I want my life to embody?
Because I have lots of new choices in front of me that just weren't there before.
Weren't there before, exactly.
Yeah, but let's do a more mundane one, Jack. What's one in your life?
That's a success?
Yeah, the thing that we would not think of typically as a trial.
Well, the one most important one in my life was, I hope I don't bore you with the details of my life, but I was raised in a small agricultural community in Oregon. And in elementary school, up through the fifth grade, I was in the elementary school in that particular town. And I did okay in school, but I did not excel in school, particularly as I recall. At least my image, at least of my time then, is that I was a fairly average, or maybe above average, but not really an excellent student. And part of it was because I didn't have any reason to think that I was supposed to be one. It was a little bit uncool to be, you know, to be a good student.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the sixth grade, we moved to the other end of the state, to an entirely new community. I knew absolutely nobody. So I go into this new class. We have an exam relatively early in the year after having moved. And I didn't have any friends. I didn't have anything to distract me. I didn't have anything to do. So I studied for the exam and took the exam, and I got the highest grade in the class. And all of a sudden, there were...
The new boy, the smart boy.
The new boy was the smart boy, and all of a sudden I stood out, and I had something that was a basis for some recognition, and I had found a newfound tool for social acceptance that I had never realized was there before. So I spent the rest of my academic career until college trying to milk that for all it's worth, not only so much for social acceptance, but for self-acceptance, for my own self-image, that I got an incredible amount of self-esteem from my grade point average, from my academic success. Now, was that a blessing? Well, in the sense it was an achievement, it was a success, it was a victory, it was a blessing on the one hand. On the other hand, it ended up being the largest, literally the largest trial of my life, I think. And maybe I've already told the story about being in college and literally flunking a physics midterm for reasons I won't get into, and that engendered a real spiritual moral crisis, a crisis of faith that, you know, I came within a hair's breadth of telling God to go to hell and giving up on this Christianity thing, but I just couldn't do it. And that was a watershed experience in my life. But really, basically, it became clear that my success had become literally my idol. And God one day took my idol, threw it on the ground, and smashed it under his heel right in front of me and asked me what I was going to do about it. That was a trial. I mean, that was one of the most severest trials of my life. Now,
it was because it was your idol, or it was the place where your identity had taken its shape.
Right.
And in a sense, you were losing yourself.
That's how it felt to me. Destroy my academic record, you destroy me, God.
Because that had become the basis of you all the way from sixth grade, and you said you melted it for all it was worth. Wow.
Yeah. Now, actually, it was a failure that engendered the actual trial itself in that case, but it was a failure that would have been meaningless outside the context of having been really tested all along. Jack, what are you going to do with this? Is this going to become your... are you going to invest your life in your academic success? Is that what your life is going to be all about? And I was really going strongly in the direction of saying, yes, this is what I'm going to make my life all about. And then God said, well, let's take it away from you, and then ask that question all over again.
So it was a trial in the sense that you had to evaluate, where do I want to go with my life? Do I want my identity to be soaked up in being bright?
Mm-hmm.
Or is my identity going to be something other than, more than that?
Right, exactly. What's going to be the foundation, Jack? What's going to be the meaning and significance and purpose of your life? That's a hard question you're going to have to ask, Jack. And I want it to, God is saying to me, I want it to be me. I want obedience to me, service of me, relationship with me to be what your life is all about. What do you want it to be all about, Jack? So anything in my life, and recognize that that's going to be tailor-made to the person. I mean, I was surrounded by people who are routinely flunking their midterms, and it was no skin off their nose. It was no big deal to them at all. But it's because they weren't me. You know, it's because their life had not gone the way my life had gone. They had not set up the same idols in their life that I had set up in mine. They didn't worship the same God that I worshiped, the same gods that I worshiped. It's God with a small g. And so that wouldn't have been a trial to them. For them to flunk that physics midterm would not have been a trial to them. For me, it was one of the greatest trials of my life.
And I really like that point, because I think lots of us could look and say, well, you know, I'm a lot more mature than Jack because that's not ever been an issue for me. Well, I don't. That may be true, or maybe not be. But lots of times we don't struggle with the same things other people do, and yet we struggle as much as other people do with our own issues. And I think none of us has a place to say I'm free from struggle, or I'm free from idols. I think a lot of our trials comes in the form of, am I willing to give up this idol that I've made out of my life? And I think we all really work at choosing some kind of idol, and very often choosing, in the sense, lots of times, like it did for you, it falls into our lap.
Right, and those idols can be very noble things. It can be ministry, it can be a church, it can be my religion, it can be my family, it can be my children. I mean, that things that really are valuable are some of the most important things in life that we've invested in this world, that we've invested ourselves in. And as things go in the world, they are good. They are the best things to invest ourselves in. But we've still exaggerated their importance relative to God's agenda and God's purposes.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Well, I was thinking, just for purpose of example here, I want to talk more about, you know, just very, very difficult tribulations that we go through and that end up being trials in our life. I think we're going to have to save that for another program, because we're running out of time and I don't want to truncate it. So I was thinking if I can talk about a situation in my life that really, really has been a trial for me. Up
great
for it?
Yeah.
As you're talking, I was trying to think, you know, what is it, you know, early in life that really, really spun me around, really tested and evaluated what I was made of. And, you know, I think it was a lot with my decision to marry my husband. I had really, I really worked at having social standing in my, I didn't have it in up through junior high, and then I worked really hard in my high school to have it, and then later on. And I worked it in lots of different ways, by being competent, by being pretty bright, not Stanford bright like you, but, you know, having kind of a cool B+, A-, you know, average. So I was really hanging in there in the upper three quarters. I really worked at my appearance. Did I already say that? I worked at the boyfriends that I had. I did some pretty awful things. I remember one time a boy invited me to the prom, or I don't know, I think it was a prom, and then this other guy that I thought was cuter and more cool invited me, and so I just dropped the first guy. I told him I didn't want to go and just went with the second guy. That was kind of the way I lived my life. I was just kind of an opportunist and tried to get the most out of everything that I possibly could in order to, you know, boast my self-esteem, as I thought it was, and my social standing. When I met my husband, Larry, I just did definitely not think that he was going to boost my social standing. I had dated guys that were pretty, had a lot of charisma, had a lot of following. I wasn't really necessarily concerned in what kind of character they had, but what kind of, how they would reflect on me in terms of the majority of the public. And Larry came along and he kind of just really created a problem for me. I remember, you know, spending a little bit of time with him and coming home and sitting on my bed and talking to my roommate and just kind of perplexed about it and kind of upset about this relationship with him. And we were just friends. We just hung out a couple of times. And she looked at me and she said, "Well, Christine, you don't have to marry him." And I remember thinking, "Yeah, I do." How could I not marry somebody who's obviously got the qualities of somebody who I am saying with my words, though not with my actions, that I value? Because I was a believer then, and I do believe I was at that time. But I just really think this decision to be with Larry was really evaluating where I wanted to go with my life. Really, it was a crossroads. Mm-hmm. And when I married him, I was very, very aware of that. I was very aware, not as I couldn't articulate it as well as I can now, but I remember the day I got married, just going to the place where we got married outside and standing there and trying to imagine that this is the direction my life was going to go. And it was like two roads diverged within the wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And I definitely had that sense that I was going down a very different road than I had been choosing all along. And in fact, up until the day I got married, I had my dad mostly plan my wedding, because I just couldn't allow myself to know what I was giving up, and just had to almost keep myself, you know, aligned with, I'm going to marry him, and I really can't even think about this. And I was a jerk, you know, a lot of the times in the first several years of our marriage, because I had decided I wanted to go in this direction, which Larry embodied exactly what I love and what I hold dear today. But I just couldn't quite let myself go there. Are you following me?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was a long process of testing out my faith, but I started at that point, and I think looking back, it was really God who allowed me to make that decision and helped me go in a totally different direction slowly, slowly over time. But that has been a trial, and it's been, you know, obviously it's turned out really well. Mm-hmm. I like the direction I went in. I'm so thankful for the direction I went in. My vows included, boy, this is such a gift. It's a gift that I wanted, and it's a gift that I absolutely did not want at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's our lives, Jack. There's our idols that kind of crushed under our feet, and we ended up choosing God.
Yeah. I think the choice of a marriage partner is often falls into the category of an important trial, because it really raises all kinds of issues about what our life is all about and what we think is important, what we think is valuable. It's such a crucial issue that brings all kinds of value judgments together in one spot. So I think that for a lot of people, and was for me, is a very important crossroads.
Hey, we've got 30 seconds. Tucker over there is waving the sign in front of our faces. You know, we haven't gone back and summarized what we've said today.
Well, we'll probably have to say more about this and have a future program on it, but the road we were headed down is to try to explore what's the process that God uses to bring us to the sanctification that we've been talking about for weeks and weeks and weeks. How does he do that? And at the heart of how God does that are these things called trials and tribulation and suffering, that I just don't think there's any way to sanctification without going through the suffering and these things that the Bible calls trials.
The staff of McKenzie Study Center has written a book on interpreting and understanding the Bible.
It is what they call a common sense approach. They believe the Bible communicates God's wisdom to us in normal human language, and this requires us to be good readers. This also means we need to see each of the biblical authors as trying to communicate a particular set of ideas to a particular audience. But this is not always easy. In fact, it's hard work. What is needed is a set of godly principles to guide us in our interpretation. The authors of Biblical Interpretation, A Common Sense Approach, offer a reasonable guide to those principles. Call McKenzie at 541-485-4801 to order your copy.
Jack, you have been on financial support, I believe, for about 18 years, you said.
Yeah.
That is a really, really long time. In fact, it's kind of staggering to me. What's that been like for you?
Boy, you know, I don't have anything to compare it to anymore. It's been so long. It's been my life. There have been times where I really didn't know whether the money was going to come in, and I was actively looking for jobs because I just didn't know if I was going to be able to feed my family. And those have been really rough times, but really important times. Some of the more important crisis situations in my life where God has really got my attention, and I've had to ask myself, who's in charge here? Are you running your life, or is God running your life? And came to some, I mean, was forced to come to some pretty firm conclusions that God really had the right to do with my life whatever he wanted to do with my life, whether he had my approval or not. And those were very important times. But looking back, you know, one of the most striking things when you ask that is a group of people, a handful of people, who have faithfully supported me every month for all 18 years. And most of the people who have been most faithful are people that if I saw them on the street, I couldn't recognize them. I wouldn't know who they were. They just early on decided that they wanted to support my ministry. One couple lives in New Jersey. I never see them. When they started supporting me, I barely knew who they were. But they have faithfully supported me for 18 years.
Do you even know them today?
Only by name. I mean, I could, but as I say, I couldn't spot them on the street if I ran into them. And I've often reflected on what an incredible commitment that is, how faithful and responsible and conscientious that is, because I don't do that. I'm not that faithful. But it's been a real steady, not only the financial impact, but the kind of emotional and the emotional support that lends for people who are just steady and reliable and faithful has been really an important thing.
Are you saying just an incredible encouragement to you?
Yes. Uh-huh, yeah.
To see that and be the recipient of their generosity also.
Yeah. Because I'm not doing anything for them. I'm not a friend. I don't have any other input into their life. I probably have barely any input in their life. I'm not even sure they benefit all that much from the study and the teaching that I do. They're ministering to me. I'm not ministering to them. It's really been significant.
So here we are again in a position where we need financial support. And I guess it's just consistent with what you're very used to. I'm not used to this, Jack.
Yeah.
You are.
And we're not asking money for us. We're asking money for just to pay the broadcast costs and the expenses for the program. I have a whole other network of support for me personally. But what we're asking for now is just people who want to support the purchase of broadcast time and overhead costs for this radio program.
If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Thank you for listening.